This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back. This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
Hello, thank you for downloading the Times Redbox podcast. I am Luke Jones, not Matt Chorley. Matt is off all this week on an Easter break. Well, I say Easter break, he's in the Cayman Islands with his family and Mrs. Sunak. He's trying to write off his tour losses against tax. He'll tell you about it next week. Anyway, on the podcast today, we are going to be hearing about the French presidential election. So we've had round one, round two is looming. And although Emmanuel Macron came out on top, 30% of French voters voted for the far right. We'll find out what on earth that means for the actual decider in a fortnight shortly. But first, let's hear from our columnists, Libby Purvis and Carol Lewis. Either of you got a good snitching story? Either you snitching on somebody or being snitched on, Libby, you must have.
Oh, not since school, and we do not speak of it. nuns can be very unforgiving.
You snitched on a nun?
No, I may have been snitched on by a nun.
I see.
This is very intrusive. This is very intrusive. I shall take you to court.
Okay, all right. Well, we won't press any further. Carol, anything that we can broadcast?
No, I don't think so. No, I'm going to deny everything.
All right. Well, let's first of all get to the thing which is on the front of most of the papers this morning, the round one of the election in France. Carol, it seems, again, interestingly, not just Emmanuel Macron about how he's been able to maintain some level of support after all these various cost of living woes have continued to bite, but actually the far right has done incredibly well in this first round. Marine Le Pen, of course, on 23% at one point, but it's 30% when you add together all the far right.
I know, it's worrying, isn't it? It's incredibly worrying, particularly given what's going on in Ukraine and the far right accusations there. I think Macron has lost support, and that's, I'm not sure how much this is. People are voting for the far right because they want to vote for the far right, or they're voting for the far right because they see them as the only viable alternative to Macron.
Yes, and also it is, I guess, a question of them being particularly peeved about the options that they have on show. The two main parties, the Socialists and the Republicans, absolutely nowhere to be seen. In fact, losing their deposit, it seems, and their ability to claim expenses for this first round, so badly have they done. So it is actually just a real furious shake-up in the politics there as well.
Yes, yes, definitely. That's the problem, isn't it, with the shake-up, that it throws out unfortunate results sometimes. There could be a lot of people who have voted for the far right who are trying to shake things up and don't actually want them to get in. And we've seen that ourselves here. People voting for things they don't necessarily think are going to get in, but think will shake the system up.
Libby, what do you think of what we're hearing out of France? Round one, and although Emmanuel Macron ahead, the far right as a group are on 30%. Marine Le Pen, of course, just shy of that.
I think Macron will probably win again, but I think he'll be very shaken up, and everybody will be very shaken up by how close Le Pen is apparently getting. Le Pen is trying to soften the act, I believe, very much, But I would see it as probably Macron coming through. I hope so. Anyway, though I'm no great fan of his. You know, it's the least worst option.
Why do you say that?
Because Le Pen's views are so sharply right, and because I think she would encourage an entire sort of tranche of France to feel energized towards the right, by the extreme right, by this, and this is the last thing we need at the moment. As I say, Macron, you know, he's in no way perfect, but I think he's the better bet of the two.
And of course, Carol, it's not just relevant for what's happening for people in France, but also if you think about the situation with the war in Ukraine and how much the sanctions imposed on Russia depends on some kind of European unity, President Le Pen could change things quite dramatically if she were in office soon.
Yes, absolutely. It could change everything. I mean, it just doesn't bear thinking about, does it? But I'm with Libby. I can see why people wanted an alternative to Macron. And I think the problem is there wasn't a viable alternative. And people, as much as they sympathise with the situation in Ukraine, will be thinking about their own lives when they vote for their own president. That will be forefront of their minds.
Yeah. And do you think, Libby, we're going to see... We're seeing a sort of precursor about what might happen here in the UK, because, of course, in France, everyone was expecting the election to be about the pandemic. I guess as we were expecting elections to be soon here. But there it is, just dominated by the cost of living. And we've got local elections coming up in May, elections in various parts of the UK. Do you think actually there'll be something similar of an angry shake-up as a result of what's happening here as well?
No, I think we'll swing quite the other way. I think we're going to swing in a leftward direction. I think that's what this cost of living crisis will do. It will create a lot of anger about unfairness in society and the massive wealth gap in society and the erosion over the last 20 years of a lot of common things which make life better for people, you know, parks and libraries and good schools. I think if we swing, it won't be towards the right, it'll be towards the left.
Can I ask you both about the Chancellor's home life? And by way of introduction, I'm going to read a letter that's in the Times this morning from Vernon Bogdanore, who's a professor of government at King's College London, no stranger to these airwaves on Times Radio. He says, perhaps the best comment on the unattractive campaign against Akshata Murthy was made more than 120 years ago by Arthur Balfour when Joseph Chamberlain was arraigned because companies run by members of his family had flourished on government contracts. Those eligible for government, said Balfour, would be nobody who has any relation or any money to invest, and nobody who inspires sufficient confidence to be made a trustee, adding, quote, wanted a man to serve Her Majesty with no money, no relations, and inspiring no general confidence. Carol, is that fair?
No, I don't think that's fair. I think, as we discussed before, I don't think politics should be closed to the rich. And of course they can have families. In fact, it's better if they do have families. I think this is a difficult situation, and it has not looked good for Sunak. I mean, he did all the things he was supposed to do at the beginning. He declared everything up front. It does appear that he didn't get very sound advice. I mean, why nobody thought to say to him when he took the job of Chancellor, hey, look, this might not look good. You know, you putting up taxes when your own household aren't paying the same taxes as everyone else. I think he should have got some better advice on that. It definitely, he appears to have been let down on that front. He also, I think general perception is that the Sunak household don't come across as very committed to being in Britain. The Chancellor backed Brexit while he had a green card. That looks dubious. Whether it is or not, it does look dubious. And his wife has persuaded people that she's only here temporarily. It doesn't look good. I'd like to think the people who are setting the policies I'm going to have to live by in the future are going to be here alongside me in the future.
So that's interesting. Libby, do you agree then? So it's not necessarily that voters will be troubled by this individual declaration and how he's accounted for this, but more to Carol's point that Rishi Sunak is appearing increasingly to all of us to be one of those, what Theresa May would call, sort of citizen of nowhere.
I don't agree, actually. I tend to be on Team Sunak because I think he's one of the most intelligent, hardest working, most professional of the cabinet. I think he was handed a hideous job as Chancellor very suddenly and very shortly before the pandemic hit, if you remember. You know, almost the first things he had to do were to hurl himself at the furloughs and you know, how the heck to, you know, how much money to put into vaccination and so on. I think he's done a pretty good job. I think the problem is the richness. It is just the richness, and that is not really his fault. You know, his wife is the daughter of a very rich man. Obviously, the very rich man may have sort of rather hoped his daughter would remain an Indian citizen and a non-dom and so on. We don't know what the family situation is. But I just think that this terrible thing of he's so rich and therefore we hate him is it's absurd. It's all over social media. You know, these people, they don't understand. They don't understand money. You know, they're not like us. Well, I don't want politicians to be like us. You know, I want some, all sorts of different backgrounds. And I think the Balfour letter is a very sensible one. But I'm just tired of this business of just everybody resenting billionaires. I don't resent billionaires if they're doing good things. I resent them very much if they do bad things.
Is there also an element of political naivety here, though, Carol? If you just take what Libby said there, but on top of this, on how Rishi Sunak has handled this, namely, first of all, maybe disclosing too much about his wife's tax situation to civil servants when he became a minister, which is thought to be how this then was known amongst a certain number of people and was able to be leaked now. A cannier politician might have actually handled this better.
Oh, that's damned if you do, damned if you don't, isn't it? I think he did the right thing, disclosing everything up front. I think he absolutely was trying to do the right thing. I think if he'd kept it quiet and it'd come out, it would look even worse for him. I don't think he looks bad on that score. I think he does look like he tried to do the right thing. I just think it's going to play out badly with the electorate. I really do.
And do you think maybe we're approaching a point, Libby, as was suggested in one of the papers this morning, where we actually go a bit American like this, well, minus Donald Trump, and have our senior politicians just publish their tax returns, just get it all out on the table. Let's have a look.
I want everyone's tax return published, as in the Scandinavian countries. I want yours on the table. I want mine on the table. I want everybody's on the table. I think, and also I love the Norwegian thing, where I believe that you have to find out who asked for it. You know, in other words, anyone can look at your tax return, but you know who they were. Your talk of snitching this morning, that's the thing. No, I think massive financial openness in every direction is a healthy thing. And then people can maybe sort of stop hating people who they suspect of having too much money and hate them on some kind of more reasonable principle.
Well, Carol, I can imagine you'd definitely be behind that with your property section hat on, wanting, I guess, to find out a bit more about some of these large houses you occasionally write about.
Oh, gosh, yes, that would be great. It really
Full
would.
Disclosure, I mean,
yes. I mean, the Economic Crime Bill is going to try and do that. But I think at the end of the day, when you've got a lot of shell companies and offshore investments, there are plenty of ways around it. And policing it is going to be a huge problem.
A couple more things from both of you. One thing I wanted to mention, Libby, I thought you would have an interesting view on this. Did you see out of the Olivier Awards last night, Liz Carr, who won Best Supporting Actress for her role in The Normal Heart at the National Theatre? She's a wheelchair user, and she said that actually venues should offer a COVID-safe performance, so, quote, theatre can remain accessible even to those of us who have health conditions. You know, so concerned is she about the fact that actually you go to the theatre at the moment, nobody's got a mask on. She said that makes it a difficult prospect for her. She hasn't been in the 2 years apart from being on stage herself. Is that something that you'd back, or does that belong to a different age?
I don't think it's really practical, and not just in terms of theatre finances, which obviously did suffer a lot under distancing. I wear a mask if anyone near me is in a mask in a theatre, or if it's very, very crowded. I wear a mask, you know, as a courtesy. But the point is that if you really were going to try and do a proper COVID-safe thing, you'd have to make people wear FP2 masks. That's the ones that look like snouts and are too tight and are absolutely horrible to wear, you know, like these unfortunate health service people who have to do it all the time. They'd need FP2 masks and not those ridiculous little paper ones or silly little ones made of bits of cloth which don't do anything, you know, where the air gets out all around them. And you'd also have to have really solid distancing, which would mean having a third or less of your normal audience in. So I don't think it's actually practical to say, you know, immunocompromised performances. Some theatres might manage it, but I think it would, I don't think there'd be much of it at all. On the whole, I have to say, I have found, I've been in every theatre that opened at every single point in the pandemic that theatres opened, I was in them. And I never caught it at all until I went to a blasted cocktail party thing where people are standing up basically shouting in each other's faces in an ill-ventilated room. I think there are a lot of far more dangerous places than theatres and concert halls. I found everybody's pointing the same way, sitting in a well-ventilated room, because theatres have got really cold, as you know. They've upped the ventilation. I've found theatres remarkably safe myself, and I found a lot of other places much less safe. So I don't really think that one will fly.
But still, Carol, it's a worry, isn't
it? She was good. She was great in The Normal Heart, by the way. She was very good.
Yeah, she was fantastic. But I guess the worry is, Carol, is that she was saying that she hasn't been to theatre in the past 2 years, apart from being in that play where everyone on stage around her was testing every day. She said she'd be too worried. So either these, you know, immunocompromised performances, as Libby's called them. Also, she said, could we try and encourage some of these organisations to continue to do live streaming and online for people who really do feel unsafe at the thought of going in, you know, a big theatre packed full of people?
I mean, to Libby's point, I agree totally. And one thing you don't do while you're sitting in the theatre is talk. And I thought that would be the main risk. So that, but I would like to see them, regardless of the immunocompromised situation, I'd like to see them continue with live streaming if they can do so, because I would like to, the theatre to be opened up to far more people. I think if you're outside London at the moment, you struggle a little to see some of the top performances, and it's great that they do live streaming. So if we can continue with that would be good.
We have agreement there. Just finally, Libby, a word on your column in the paper this morning. Disruptive eco-protesters harm their cause. You take us through some of the many protests you've seen in your time, including the British Leyland cat dropping walkout, which I have no idea what that is, so maybe you'll have to explain.
You're too young. You never lived the 70s.
Well, go on. What's your point? Basically, these days, especially the sort of eco-lot, they're doing themselves down.
It was just sort of impatience, because this is an important cause: emissions, climate change, pollution, wasteful manufacturing. But the ongoing self-indulgent recreational XR and Just Stop Oil protests, making petrol stations run dry and people drive around desperately to get to doctors in rural areas and choking up the cities and gluing themselves to roads, it alienates public opinion. If you alienate public opinion, you make your cause seem bullying and preachy and fanatic and borderline fascist. And in a democracy, that affects future votes. And the simple example I gave was that the 1970s was sort of non-stop protest for every description, disrupting people 3 day week and all the rest of it. Did it leave everybody saying, up the workers, hurrah for socialism? No, it didn't. It brought in Mrs. Thatcher in 1979, and we have basically had conservative or faux conservative governments ever since. So I do not think that the protesters are doing themselves any favours, and I wish they'd stop, although I back their intentions.
What was the cat dropping business?
It was the usual sort of thing. There was some assembly line stopped entirely because a cat had got in and there was a piece of cat turd on the floor. But there was every excuse to walk out. I mean, there was another really shocking one where people suddenly said they wouldn't work near any black person because they were different and maybe they might smell different and they shouldn't be near them. They'd catch something. I mean, there was ridiculous strikes as well as absolutely necessary and excellent strikes. But it went on and on. It became a kind of mania, you know, stick it to the man. Yeah. And it was really boring to live with for ordinary people.
That was Carol Lewis from the Times Property Section and Libby Purvis, Times columnist extraordinaire. Next, we will think about the French presidential election and where it might head next.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
And now it's time for this. You've no Chorley, but we'll always have Paris. The election is well underway in France, and after round one yesterday, we now know who'll be facing off in round two in a fortnight. Le Pen and Macron.
Rien n'est fait. En avant.
Et voilà donc pour cette harangue d'Emmanuel Macron. Je compte sur vous. Rien n'est fait. Un discours qui a pris de l'ampleur.
Merci beaucoup. Merci beaucoup, mes amis, mes chers compatriotes. Merci.
At this decisive moment for the future of the nation, nothing must be as it was before. I would like to take the hand of everyone who would like to work for France to join me. I'm ready to invent something new.
Le peuple français s'est exprimé et me fait l'honneur d'être qualifié au second tour face au président sortant.
In the next 5 years, we'll look at migration, security, economy, social, energy, Europe, military and diplomacy. And my commitment is without fail, as far as the subject matter is concerned, I will ensure that France will be a power of peace and I will restore in all areas sovereignty of France. In other words, for the French people, the possibility to think for themselves and to defend their own interests.
So there we have it, two of the victory speeches last night. This half hour, we're going to look at the result and what could happen next, and also selfishly what it might mean for not just us at home, but also for the Ukrainians fighting for their life as well. In a moment, we'll hear from an MP from Macron's En Marche party, and later we're going to speak to a former British ambassador to France to ask what this means for us. But first, let's speak to Charles Bremner, The Times' man in Paris, who, of course, has been popping up on this show every week since the start of the year in the run-up to this first round. Welcome back, Charles.
Thank you.
So it's on course for a close second round, is that right?
Yes, we've been expecting a second round like this for most of the last 5 years, in fact. It was going to be very easy for Macron until about a month ago, and now it's tightened up. Macron is still ahead, but Marine Le Pen is snapping at his heels, and it is not impossible that for the first time a leader who was until now considered far right actually becomes president of France.
Hmm. And just explain for us, first of all, the situation, Macron's situation. He was saying there, we heard in his victory speech, quote, "I'm ready to invent something new." Is the problem that even after just 5 years, he's now seen as old and establishment?
Yes, of course, he got in 2017 as the new man promising a revolution, from a man from outside politics, although he was from within the establishment. He is now trying to find a way of creating a coalition behind him, which will help him defeat Le Pen. For the moment, this means aiming to the left, because the big reservoir of votes from yesterday are those that went to Jean-Luc Mélenchon, the far-left campaigner, who got nearly the same as Le Pen, 22%. Macron and Le Pen are appealing to these voters now, or at least they're appealing to them not to abstain in this election.
And in terms of Macron's pitch for those voters, is it all about the cost of living and what he might do in a particularly sort of left-wing appeasing way to help cure that ill?
Well, Macron's first challenge is to make himself more likable to people who don't like him, which is a majority of the French. The the people who voted Le Pen and Mélenchon have one thing and big thing in common is their contempt for Macron. He has to show that he understands the people. Both Mélenchon and Le Pen and Zemmour say they represent the people against Macron, who's the elite.
And where does that dislike of Macron come from? Is it entirely personal, or is it down to specific sort of policy decisions?
Well, this goes way back, baby, back to the French Revolution in 1789. France has never really relinquished the civil strife, which it's had since then, in which there is a ruling elite, which is opposed by the people in one form or the other. Sometimes the people are on the left, sometimes the right. But it has been multiplied by Macron's inability since 2017 to soothe, to heal this split in society, which he promised always to do.
And what of Marine Le Pen's situation and how she's been able to somewhat soften her image? I think I read yesterday, correct me if I'm wrong, that she has a diploma in cat grooming.
Yes, she's making a lot of that. This is the new friendly, milder Marine Le Pen. She's even lowered her voice. She speaks quietly and makes a big attempt to smile on all occasions. She has managed, for the moment, not to talk so much about her key elements of her platform, which are against immigrants and foreigners, and against Muslims, and against the European Union. But this will all have to come out now. Macron will do his best to expose her as somebody who is potentially extremely dangerous for France.
And I just wondered, Charles, if you could address someone who's just texted into us to say, everyone is saying far right. What does that actually mean? Can you please define far right rather than just using these labels this person has said on texts?
The label has been used since 1972 for the National Front, which was founded by Marine Le Pen's father. She took over the party in 2011 and ran for the presidency. She adopted most of his basic formula, manifesto, but softened a lot around the edges. And she got rid of the old fascist anti-Semitic side. And she has posed as friend of the people. But sorry, on far right, she is still regarded as far right by the entire French political spectrum, except her own, and by all French media and by all French political scientists.
What is happening elsewhere in French politics with this? Because one of the other interesting facets of the results we had overnight from this first round is the absolute collapse of the two sort of formerly main parties, the Republicans and the Socialists. Yeah. Is this the final nail, at least for one of them?
It's pretty awful. They've gone under 5% for the two dominant parties of the last 60, 70 years. They're the Gaullist Party, which is now called the Republicans, and the Socialists. They're on life support, or more than that, they're death's door on the national level, because they still control most big French town halls and most of the regions and counties of France.
And how will this next second round play out, Charles? Just briefly on what we're going to see over the next fortnight. Is Macron going to be fully back on the campaign trail and not bothering so much with Ukraine? And are he and Marine going to be touring the country right round again and again and again?
Yes, Macron is this time throwing himself into it. He made the mistake of staying out of the race for the first round. He cast himself as the statesman taking care of Ukraine after being the statesman taking care of the pandemic. He's realized, he's even admitted, that he came in too late and people don't really know what he's offering apart from a rise in the retirement age to 65, which is unpopular.
And what about Marine?
She is going to do her best to keep the moderate image and to woo the left-wing voters. Those are the Mélenchon voters, and to encourage people not to abstain. In fact, it's become a referendum on Macron, the election, and both of them are going to try to appeal to the underdogs, the Gilets Jaunes, the yellow vest protesters of 2 years ago, the lower income, and the young, because it's the young who voted Mélenchon mainly.
Charles, we'll just leave you with some chanting, which we heard when we heard some of what happened last night. Let's just hear it again. And I want you to translate for us. This is Emmanuel Macron was coming onto the stage last night.
Yeah.
Now, my French is dreadful. I can just hear them saying Canal Plus, it sounds like, but you're going to tell me it's not.
They're saying 5 ans de plus, 5 more years.
Five more years. Oh, I see. Well, there we go. Charles, well, many, many more years for you and for covering this patch for us. I appreciate it. That's Charles Bremner, the Times' man in Paris. There's absolutely loads from Charles in the paper today if you want more of his analysis and reporting of it. Well, let's turn now to actually one of Emmanuel Macron's own MPs. This is Mireille Clapot, who is an MP for Macron's En Marche party in Drôme in southeast France. Mireille, welcome.
Hello.
Thanks very much for your time. First of all, your reaction to last night, your man on top.
Well, of course, I was satisfied and a very high sense of relief because we are not sure at all that Emmanuel Macron would have this 28% and be the first. And we knew that certainly Marine Le Pen would have a high score, but fortunately she was only second. So we are satisfied and optimistic for the second round.
Charles Bremner, our correspondent in Paris, was just explaining for us that part of the problem for Emmanuel Macron going forward is that a lot of French people don't like him. It's not necessarily about what he's doing, it's just about him. They don't like him. Do you recognise that problem? And is that something you think he is successfully working on?
Well, the people meet on markets, in the street, etc., usually they are aware that he's a very clever man, that he's fully dedicated to this mandate of president. What they don't like with him is these small sentences that he could have, saying that it's very easy to find a new job and that you only need to cross the street. When he said something about the people that don't want to be vaccinated, and he told them in French, I want to emmerder them, and this they don't like. But most of them recognize that he was the only one to be able to face the terrible war and in Ukraine and the pandemic. So, of course, he has some defaults. He's a human and not a robot. And, of course, some of them don't like him, but I don't think in the majority.
Of course, the main issue you mentioned there, the pandemic and, of course, the war raging in Ukraine at the moment. But a lot of people heading to the polls in France are worried about the cost of living. Inflation in France, north of 5%. Energy costs are up 28%. They see Emmanuel Macron and say, you're not doing enough.
The state, the government has been helping the French people, French population for a long time because during the pandemic, France was the most helpful country for the restaurant, for the small shops, for the small companies. And now it has become a habit, I would say. And when the cost of fuel has exploded, there was a plan to help people. And now there is a reduction on the liter at the pump. There is a minus 15 or minus 18 cents on each liter, and they know that. So of course, it's never enough, but really, this plus money directly given to the poor people, 100 euro, they know that, I think. They are aware of it, and they recognize it's very helpful for them.
And if that is so helpful, if that is so generous, why have 30% of French voters turn to the far right this time round?
Yes, you're right. It's very worrying, and it's bad news that Marine Le Pen plus Eric Zemmour, so the far right candidates, have more than 30%. And, you know, my analysis is that in France, there is an anger. Maybe it's due to the revolution, as you mentioned, but I think that since the Gilets Jaunes, the Yellow Jackets movement, people are still hungry. And it's difficult when you discuss with people in the street. They tell you oh, yes, I'm against, I'm angry, my life is difficult. But they have free education, they have a free access to health. Unemployment is at a very low rate. So they are angry and they are anxious, but not about their personal situation, about a global situation where they see a threat. And I have to admit, even if it is not my values at all, that there is a feeling against foreign people, against immigration. And again, it's a kind of schizophrenia. French people are very open and very generous to welcome Ukrainian refugees, but they fear the danger that could be provided by immigration. So it's very easy for Le Pen and Zemmour to use this feeling and to make them having fear of what could be the future. But the real problems like ecological transition or Europe or all these things that we have to face, they are not in the program of the far right.
But does that not concern you, though? And does blame not partly fall at the feet of 5 years of En Marche and Emmanuel Macron, that for whatever all the various issues that there have been, it's not just that French voters are turning to an alternative or a particularly dramatic alternative, they're turning to the far right and in some instances a big bunch of racists?
Well, this is certainly due to the fake news and the information. A lot of people still take the information on some media that are not really reliable. And against it's a kind of a schizophrenic behavior because life is going as usual business. People have more jobs. The problem of all the companies are to find candidates.
You're saying that 30% then they are misguided completely. Your point is they don't realize how good it is and they're getting the wrong information on the news, that they are deluded.
I think that there is a gap between the situation of some people and the way they feel it, and we are reducing inequalities. We are, I think, really improving the situation. Of course, we had the yellow jackets, and there is the increase in the price of energy. And there are some reforms that we could not do. For example, the retirement reform, and we have to be able to give higher wages to the people that take care of all people. We have dedicated a problem with single mothers.
Okay.
But it's true that seeing how people are angry and how they vote for extremes, I think this is not really in coherence with the real situation and the real real help that was given by the state this last month.
Thanks very much for your time this morning. Mireille Clapeau, who's an MP for the En Marche party in Drôme in south-east France. Looking back on what happened last night after round one of the presidential election and forward to what might happen after round two in a fortnight. Let's continue thinking about the French presidential election, what happened last night, what could be upon us soon, and how it might affect us here in the UK and also around the world as well. Lord Ricketts, Peter Ricketts, is live with us, formerly many things, but for today's purposes, formerly UK ambassador to France. And Peter, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for your time. And first of all, we were just hearing from an MP from Emmanuel Macron's own party a moment ago. I don't know if you heard it. She's had a sort of interesting diagnosis as to why the far right have been doing increasingly well at the moment. She said, seeing how people are reacting, this is not coherent with the real situation. It almost sounds as if people from Macron's own side are completely baffled as to the situation and think that all these people are deluded.
Yes. Well, I mean, just to look at the result, Macron actually did very well. He increased his score over his first round in 5 years ago. And the polling surge that people thought Marine Le Pen would benefit from didn't quite arrive. But you're right, if you put the scores together for the two far-right candidates, it's 30%. If you add the nationalist far-left candidate, Mélenchon, it's over 50%. Mm. Over 50% voting for anti-system, anti-establishment candidates shows how disillusioned everyone is in France with the old political setup and how polarized things are at the moment. And that is certainly something that the Macron camp now need to understand. Mm. I think in French elections, there's always a difference between the first and the second rounds. In the first rounds, people vote with a heart, if you like. And in the second round, they have to really look at the two candidates and think, which one do I want to be president of the country for the next 5 years? Mm. And so there will be a difference in voting in the second round. But definitely, there's a deep disillusionment, frustration, anger with the French political system coming through.
And how do you rate Emmanuel Macron's personal performance so far? Charles Bremner, the Times' correspondent in Paris, said that, first of all, he'd been somewhat absent from this first round of campaigning, but also that French people, a good chunk of the French population, really just dislike him as a person.
Yeah, I mean, I think he really did quite well in the first round. It's a very high score to get almost 28%. But the French traditionally disliked their president. I mean, we've seen that Sarkozy, Hollande, poll ratings go down throughout a period of a presidency. Mm. And Macron has made he's personalized the role of the president very, very strongly. And there are a lot of people who really don't like him. That's true. The question I think now is for the second round, when particularly Mélenchon voters, those 20% of the voters who now have to find another home, where do they go? Mélenchon himself called clearly not to vote for Le Pen. How many of them will go to Macron? That will be a crucial thing, I think, for the second round. When they look at Macron, in the end, I think that most of them will think, actually, we don't like this guy, but if we're thinking about the presidency of France in a troubled world, he is a reliable pair of hands. And I think, therefore, he will get through, but it's going to be a lot closer than it was 5 years ago.
Yes, and one projection from French television news having it at 51-49 in their projection for round two, with Macron on top. But let's just have a look at what a victory for each of them might mean, I guess, not just for the UK, but also, most pressingly, for the situation around Ukraine as well. President Macron, back in office, free from the worries of elections, at least for the time being. What will that mean for Ukraine, and also what will that mean for the UK in terms of our various outstanding issues, not least to do with trade and the rest?
Well, Macron back and elected will mean that he's one of the most experienced politicians in Europe. Mr. Scholz in Germany is still very new. I think we know what we'll get with Macron. He will want to continue to try to keep a line open to the Russians against the day when negotiations might be possible. But he will be a staunch ally in NATO and will continue to be willing to reinforce French troops in the east of NATO and to send arms and other support to Ukraine. So he's a known quantity and he will be firmly in the mainstream of the Allied effort to support the Ukrainians while keeping a line out to Putin. For the UK, I mean, the relationship between Boris Johnson and Macron is pretty broken, to be honest. But I think if he's re-elected, they will want to try and reset that, get back to some kind of pragmatic working relationship between the two. And Macron will want to look ahead, I think, and try and put some of the squabbles of Brexit and the recent years behind him. From that point of view, I think he's a known quantity. Marine Le Pen would be a very different thing.
Well, go on. What could we expect from President Le Pen?
I mean, some of the sort of staunch Brexiteers in the UK might think that the arrival of Le Pen would be a good thing, that she's anti-EU in many ways, might be a better ally on curbing migration across the Channel and so on. I think she would be actually a very dangerous ally. She might want to try and reach out to Boris Johnson, seeing him as another sort of strong anti-EU figure. But remember that she's very anti-NATO. She has pledge to pull France out of NATO's military structure. She would have a very difficult relationship with Joe Biden. She has long-standing links to Putin, and although she's tried to play those down, I don't think that she'd be in favour of more sanctions against Ukraine. So she would be a very disruptive influence, obviously in the EU and in the wider Western alliance on Ukraine. Very, very unpredictable, unknown quantity.
That was Peter Ricketts, Lord Ricketts, ending our hop, skip and jump through round one of the French presidential election. There's more coverage of that and, of course, of all the news on Times Radio if you would like to listen live. Thank you for downloading and subscribing to this podcast. I'll be back in your ears tomorrow.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.